It's open. Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to go through this agenda in order. We're a little shorthanded today. Senator Benz is on his way. Senator Taylor is excused for the day. So I would open up a public hearing on House Bill 2101. Kyle.
Hey, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2101A is a measure that comes or was introduced on behalf of the Department of Revenue, and it's relating to partnership audits. So, and this information is in the background of the SMS, but in 2015, Congress passed the Bipartisan Budget Act, the BBA. And among other things the BBA did, one of them was changing or replacing the existing laws governing audits of large partnerships and the collection of the liability that happens after an audit occurs. So the underlying bill of House Bill 2101A is updating Oregon statutes to more or less align with the federal changes related to the partnership audits. So the legislation or the measure you see in front of you comes out of work. This is work that's being done in other states as well, but out of the multi-state tax commission that put together model legislation for different states to then take that model legislation, adapt it to its own statutes, its own tax system, and then enact that model legislation with the tweaks as necessary to align, again, the state statutes to account for the changes of the partnership audits made at the federal level.
Okay, this is pretty high level. Can you break it down a little bit more and tell us the problem we're trying to solve here?
Sure, Mr. Chair. One of the key changes, I suppose, at the federal level was, again, a partnership, this is a pass-through entity. So the way a partnership would work, or the way the tax works the partnership, is the partnership distributes the income earned for the year to the individual partners. So that's where the pass-through terminology comes from. The income is passed through to the individual partners. That income then shows up on the return, the personal income tax return of each individual partner in accordance with how the income's distributed to the individual partners. So it's passed through, and the federal changes in the case of audits of a partnership change the focus from when an audit is conducted of the partnership rather than then. So an audit's conducted, an increase in tax liability follows the audit. So some change was forced for the partnership or was found under audit, and there's additional liability. And prior to the changes at the federal level in 2015, the collection of that and the tax liability would have fallen on the individual partners. Where now with the new framework that was enacted at the federal level, the focus changes to the partnership entity rather than then having to follow through on all the individual partners. So that's the big change at the federal level. For states, of course, partnerships can exist in different states, and so it's not quite the same where the federal level accounts for all the 50 states. On the state level, there are provisions in the measure that would allow a partnership to function the same way following an audit in many cases as the federal, where they can pay on behalf of their partners, but it's not necessarily a requirement at the state level. So it could be the partnership following the audit pays the additional liability on behalf of the individual partners, or there could be the case where the individual partners would become responsible for that additional liability. So that's part of the reason why the statutes, it's not just a simple copy and paste of the changes at the federal level into Oregon statute.
Okay, Deanna Mack. Feels like kind of a connection issue.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And Kyle did a really good job of explaining a lot about what this bill is that we're asking for, including a lot of the testimony I was prepared to give today. But one of the things, besides the explanation he gave relating to how partners and partnerships are treated and the treatment in current Oregon law versus federal law, is that the MTC has been working on these model changes for some time now, because there's just been a really big increase in the number of partnerships that are out there. So we have been working with the multi-state tax Tax Commission, with the Council of State Taxation, the AICPA, the OSCPA, a number of industries, Oregon Tax Court, to make sure that this bill actually works for Oregon and revises all of the statutes that we have in place. And again, like Kyle said, we're not alone in needing to update these procedures. So we made some minor amendments in the House Committee on Revenue in consultation with our partners. Since the bill was initially drafted, there were some changes that needed to be made still. But we got agreement from all our stakeholders, and I believe there's some testimony online too in support of the bill. So if you have any questions about it generally, but the general idea is that at the federal level, partners are no longer going to be required to pay the tax. It's going to be paid by the partnership. Because of nexus issues across the state, you know, they may not have an obligation to file at the state level. So they do have to, you know, in apportionment issues, they do have to still file at the report the change at the individual level. So all these statutes changes just change that procedure to align with that new treatment at the federal level. Does that help?
Other states are doing the same thing, I hear you say.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the Multi-State Tax Commission adopted the model changes, I believe, just in January of 2019. They finally voted on them. And so we don't know what other states are doing, but other states participated in developing the concept. And so I believe that there are several other states already in the works of doing, of trying to do this.
Actually, Senator Bocas was first.
I'm sorry.
You go ahead. Okay. I'm looking through the bill.
So does anybody know what the reason for this change was?
At the federal level, Mr. Chair? I actually think, let me look at my notes and see if I have something on the reason why the federal law changed it. I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Riley, it was just because of the massive onset of, there's just so many more partners, and there are thousands of partners in those partnerships. And so it makes it easier for the IRS to, it's a better collection tool too, if you get the entity to pay rather than the individual partners.
Can you, obviously, LLCs are partnerships because the feds don't recognize LLCs. So that's how it's treated at the federal level. And the issue of having thousands of partners, obviously, this makes sense. However, we have 400,000 small businesses in the state of Oregon. And I'm skimming through here to find if there is an exit strategy for what we would call a small business. As example, you have a partnership. What you're really saying is, if you have a partner and 1,000 partners, the partner that's designated at the federal level then becomes the negotiator. And if you have 1,000 people, and I don't know, we'll say you're Hancock. There's a good one. Hancock's a limited, is a partnership here in Oregon. Got 5 or 6 of them, gazillion money. And so that's fine. But the question is let's say that the three of us are in an LLC as partners, and we designate, or the good senator to my right becomes
volunteers
to go in the audit process. Does that mean he binds us, or he has to pay for us, or you understand where I'm going here?
Yes.
Because first off, the feds don't recognize LLCs, as you know, and the issue is not Hancock, because they can pay more, as far as I'm concerned, any day of the week. That's fine. But what I'm really more concerned about is the small businesses that are out there that you actually deal with on a day-to-day basis. And then the next question as you follow up is, who are we dealing with? And I don't know that you actually really do that many partnership audits.
Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, there are provisions in this for small partnerships to elect out of this. The default is not for the partnership to pay at the state level. That's at the federal level. For Oregon, we're still going to require the partnership to that provide for the partners in the partnership to be responsible for the tax unless they elect in to having the partnership pay. And we can't require the partnership to pay because of the nexus and apportionment requirements in the state. They may not have an obligation to file here. So if there's a federal audit, and to just push it down. So we have to make a determination about whether they even have business in Oregon first, and then the apportionment related to it. So if the partnership has the option to elect in to having the partnership pay, and certainly we hope that they do that because of the improved collections related to that. The fact of the matter is at the federal level, we get revenue agent reports now, and they will no longer come in the name of the individual. So they'll only come in the name of the entity. So if we don't have this information, these statutes change, we won't be able to know which individual partners to bill based on the federal audit. It's a streamlined process for us to be able to use those revenue, what they're called revenue agent reports, and rely on those at the federal level. But if we don't know who the partners are because the IRS no longer gathers that information for us, then there's a possibility that people will not be reporting. The current statutes don't require the partnership to report to us the change. It requires the individual to report the change. So we're trying to make sure that the statutes align with this new federal practice so that Oregon gets the information it needs to be able to ensure the correctness of the return for all of the partners that are affected here. But it's an opt-out for an opt-in to be at the partnership pays level for these audit adjustments for Oregon, for the states.
Okay, so help me out here. We use the same analogy we have. The three of us are partners. We file a partnership return. We presently pay the $150, and then it's through the pass-through of the K-1s on the partnership that we pay our individual taxes. So how can the partnership above us pay? I'm at a loss here because the tax liability is with the three of us, and of course they don't pay taxes. And then the next thing is, since it's a pass-through, they don't have cash on hand because they're not a C corporation. And the next thing is why would I let him bind Hanky and I don't see an exit strategy here. So maybe Kyle can find the exit ramp for the small entities. I get the federal big partnership, that one I got. I'm with you on there. I'm just trying to figure out the impact of the small LLC, which is a partnership, like three. Does he get to bind us all? I mean,
Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, if you as a partnership choose your Oregon representative, then that person does bind the partnership, but it's your choice who that person is. There's a federal representative, and then there's also one that represents for Oregon, but that's a partnership choice. It's not someone that we require you to use, but it does require that person to be able to make actions on the behalf of the entity in the bill. I think, does that answer your question?
No, but I wouldn't send him. I'd send the accountant, and then they could send a letter to him, and he can talk to us, because I wouldn't go either. I would let the accountant do it, yeah, and the lawyer do it, yeah, and then we'd go from there. So I'm still trying to figure out how this applies in reality to a small LLC, which is the most of that I'm concerned about, right? I forget the Hancocks, the world, all that. You're with you there. And I don't see, again, I'm looking through the bill here, where is the option this bill apparently says, the way I read it, is that it's the federal, if he's designated in federal, it's the federal regardless, and that's the road we go down. And so I'm trying to see, and I fully understand that on large partnerships, you know, investment groups and REITs and things like that, I'm just on the average corner grocery store, three partners.
Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, I believe if you look, it says the Oregon Partnership Representative for the reviewed year is responsible for any action required or permitted to be taken under this section, including providing the adjustment reports to the Department of Revenue. It's on page 2 of the A and Gross Bill, line 33. Is where it begins. It also allows them to represent in front of the tax court. It's in line 27. It says the partnership's federal partnership representative shall act as a partnership's Oregon representative for the reviewed year, unless the partnership designates another person.
Another partner or
another Oregon partnership representative, which can be anybody they designate.
Can be the lawyer.
Right, could be the lawyer, could be the accountant, right?
Okay.
And I believe that they want them, once they're at the tax court level, they want them also to be able to represent in front of the tax court too. So there's some interplay between the tax court provisions as well. So, yes.
But, you know, at the tax court though, the partnership can assign, designate authorized representative, which is, you know, can be a lawyer, CPA, or anything like that. And that includes through the regular court. As you know, I'm experienced at that one. So I'm familiar with that. But I don't see the wording that you're talking about. With respect, I'm looking at this here, and it says partnership, direct partners, indirect partners, or partners. I don't see where it says designation. That's what
federal, you mean in the definitions? So what
right.
A federal a federal partnership, it's on page 1 in line 23. Federal partnership representative means the person that the partnership designated for the tax year for the partnership's representative. Or the person that IRS has appointed to act pursuant to their Internal Revenue Code.
You're in line 7. The A and Gross Federal Partnership Representative. That's
right, line 23, it's right. Section 2, sub 7.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the actual adjustment that's made at the partnership level, the partnership would be required to make sure that we know about this, if they about the change, so we can make corresponding changes at the Oregon level. There's time limits set forth in the bill for them to do that, so that we can make the corresponding change from the IRS audit.
Senator Boakley.
Okay, so go on to the other part of the question. We got 400,000 small businesses in pass-through, so the chair said, okay, we're solving a problem. What's the problem in Oregon? How many audits are we talking about? You give us some sort of magnitude of.
I know we have, Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, we have a section that does partnership audits. I don't know the count. I can find that out for you. We typically hit about, you know, in our regular audits, about 2% of the population statistically. So I don't know what the makeup of that is for partnerships. But I imagine there's a pretty good fair amount. The problem that we're trying to solve, though, and let me find it in my testimony, is that because the federal government repealed the TEFRA provisions, which is the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act of 82, which dealt with all the partnership treatment, and they now have since adopted CPAR. So without this bill, the individual partner in a partnership that has been part of one of these CPAR audits might not receive an adjustment that the partner would otherwise be required to report to Oregon, because it was given to the entity, not to the individual. So, and then the partnership would not have any tax to pay to Oregon, even if the partnership had to pay the tax, additional tax to the IRS, because Oregon law wouldn't require the entity to report to us. So it's a reporting requirement. They need to tell us, these people need to align, the partnership needs to align with the partners, so that we know who is supposed to be assessed.
So are we saying in the scenario we're using that Senator Riley is the one that's supposed to report to Oregon? Remember, he's the designation. Actually, we'll give Senator Riley. He's the individual dealing with accountants. The accountant's the one we designated. He's the lead partner. So is it?
Yeah.
I'm trying to look for, maybe Kyle can help us, like a walkthrough, an example here of what we're talking about here. A real world hypothetical, like the chair likes. Or you want to come back next time and do that? Next time, I see, okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Haas, the partnership shall file the reports with the department in this bill. So the partnership has to tell us within, not later than 180 days after the date of the federal notice of final partnership adjustment, or 90 days after the date on which the amended federal return, federal refund claim, or other similar report was done. And it goes on, and then it says the partnership shall file with the department a completed adjustments report, concede the accuracy of the IRS report, or submit with the adjustments report any other information required by the department. So, and then it goes on to say not later than 270 days after. So the point of the federal designee is to allow the IRS to engage with one person and act on that entity's, that one person can act on the entity's behalf. And so for Oregon, we'd like the same thing, and have an Oregon person, someone that's representing the partnership. But the partnership is the one that has to send this information to us according to the bill.
I mean, doesn't that's what we're doing now, because we already audit now.
Right now, Senator Haas, or Chair Haas and Senator Boquist, we get revenue agent reports from the IRS in the name of the individual, so we can make the corresponding adjustment to the individual return. What will happen in the future is it'll come in the name of the partnership return. We won't necessarily know who the partners are unless the partnership files this adjustments report with us.
Well, Mr. Chair, follow up. So what happens right now? That's what I'm trying to figure out. Well, I'm still a little lost of what we're trying to figure out here. So right now, in the scenario we had, our accountant went and he got an audit, right? And it's a federal audit. And at the end of that audit, what does he do today under the existing law?
Senator Haas and Senator Boquist, this would be prior to 20, I believe, Kyle, correct me if I'm wrong, 2018 is when this became law. So those would be audits prior to that date. The IRS would work with whoever the representative was for the audit, but the adjustments would go down to the individual taxpayers. So there may be 50,000 partners, there may be 5 partners, but those adjustments would go to the individual partners under TEFRA and provide uniformity under those provisions. And we'd get that information from the IRS through information sharing, or the taxpayer would amend their return on their own, which is what they're supposed to do, and not wait for us to do enforcement action. So this provides, this changes that process to allow the partnership to share that information with us, because they're the ones who have the information. Does that make sense?
No, but that's okay. Follow-up question. So I understand here. The present law is that somebody shall file a tax return. And what you're saying is that's not happening. So we need a new law that says the partnership shall file the tax return, the amended return. So the first people aren't filing the amended return, so you're not getting the information. So by doing it this way, you're saying that the partnership itself will now file an amended return. Am I correct here?
Senator Haas, Chair, or Senator Boquist, in part, yes. The current law at the current law at a federal level is the centralized partnership audit regime.
We're talking state level. So the feds did the audit. We owe more taxes.
Right.
What happens now before this law?
We don't have any of those adjustments yet because it just became effective with tax year 2018, which are just being filed now. So audits we expect will come in. This information will start to come in later this year and into 2020. So we haven't had to come across the scenario yet. This is a preemptive measure to make sure that our statutes align with their statutes by the time that those audits start coming in the door. Right now, we're still receiving audits that were done under TEFRA. And so the statutes are fine for that purpose, and it's working fine. Does that? It's a timing issue, I think.
Senator Riley.
So do we not know who partners are in a partnership?
Senator Haas, Senator Riley, not necessarily.
No, so there's a problem.
I don't know how that's possible.
Yeah, I don't either. So a Secretary of State must know. But... well, seriously. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So the other issue I have is, under this new situation, if we pass this bill, and honestly, whether we pass it or not, because the feds are doing what they're doing, if our partnership distributes the income the way they do, and then go out of business, what do you do?
Senator Riley, when you're winding down an entity?
It's gone. Yeah, we just shut it down.
We follow the procedures and the winding down procedures in Chapter 60, 63, and 67, I think, with the Secretary of State. And they have certain time limits in order to wind down the entity. But including the tax situation, they have to file final tax returns.
Okay. The corporation does, the partnership does?
Have a winding down process where they can continue to operate for that purpose, but they're not allowed to do business.
Okay, now I have another question.
Senator Boquist.
Okay, so they go broke. Like a quarter of all businesses just go under every year. So I don't know what the winding down thing is with the Secretary of State, and I'm not sure I completely understand, because when you file your partnership form, it's got attached to it all of the K-1 attachment, so you know exactly who's being, and the reason they file that is so that you can track it.
I'm still struggling with the deal as I get where you're going forward, but what my question was is, what do we do today? Forget about, what is the existing state law from last year in 2018? The feds audited the three of us. Were we supposed to file a return? Is that a yes, we do it? And then what are those steps presently under the law?
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist. Under TEFRA and the report, the audits that are happening prior to 2018, the federal government would send the adjustment in the name of the individual partner to the state. So we would get a revenue agent report. We would know that that individual partner, so you, amongst the four of you, we'd get four different adjustment notices. Right. Under CPAR, we will get one adjustment notice for the entire partnership, and we won't know which of the four people are up there are part of that partnership unless the partnership tells us that information under the way if we don't have this bill pass. With this bill passing, we will get that audit report, but we will also have the partners being required to report the adjustments to us. So this statute aligns the process in our current statute, which was written for TEFRA. It aligns it to the CPAR regime in under federal law now to account for those differences. So does that help? Okay, no. So when you, Senator Haas, under our current, if a partnership at the federal level is audited, right? And there's four partners, under TEFRA provisions, we would get an individual revenue agent report, four separate reports, one for each of the four of you. Under the CPAR, we are just going to get a notification for the entity.
We got that.
Right, but the entity that filed in the state of Oregon has the three of us, and then we're identified in that entity. And we do have a computer system that's supposed to know this, but are we saying the computer system doesn't know this?
The partnership return that's filed for Oregon, the 65, I believe, I don't know that it has that detail because we have been operating under the TEFRA provisions for so long, since 82. We get those K-1s, they're attached to the individual returns.
They're in the partnership return too, because that's the way the law is. So that's why I'm trying to struggle what we're trying to solve here. Other than the computer thing. So I don't know. I have no answer. There you go, Mr. Chair. Fine bill. You deal with it.
Well, I think one of the words that I heard that kind of turned my mind was preemptive. That this will try to join with the federal change down the road. Things start happening next year.
Yes, this way we won't have a federal change, so we shouldn't connect. I just don't understand it. I'm sorry.
Yes.
And we've taken enough time in this hearing today.
I understand it. I'm not sure I like it, but that's a different issue.
Well, I don't like it, but I'm trying to be optimistic here that I don't understand it, so therefore
well, maybe,
I would like it, and she would.
We will ask Deanna to follow up in offices or maybe some other piece of helpful
advice
down the road. Thank you. You did a good job.
And I apologize.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just good give and take. It's all right. Okay. All right, we'll close public hearing on 2101.
That was easy. Thank you.
And open up a public hearing on House Bill 2102.
Hey, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2102 is bill number two that was introduced on behalf of the Department of Revenue. What House Bill 2102 would do is it's allowing the Department of Revenue to disclose income tax information to a multi-jurisdictional information sharing organization that's formed with the oversight of the Internal Revenue Service and is formed to combat identity theft and fraud. So there are information sharing and analysis centers. These things are called ISICs, and they were created to ensure the protection of critical U.S. infrastructure, and one of those things would include the tax system. So there is an ISIC that's related to identity theft and tax refund fraud. And so that's formed with equal partners from the IRS, tax industry, so software and industry providers or industry preparers, and the states, with the idea being these partners to the ISIC would discuss information and leads and such related to tax refund fraud, with the idea of identifying different ways in which this is happening and ways that the different states or the IRS could combat that, or tax preparers as well. So that's the general idea behind House Bill 2102.
Okay, this one a little bit easier to understand.
Yeah, I like it even less.
She probably left the building for good, and I wouldn't blame her, but is Deanna Mac, oh, there she is.
She's standing there waiting.
Well, she's coming out. Can Kyle clarify something?
Sure.
I'm looking through the bill. Can you define information, income tax information? What are we really talking about sharing, or is that something DRA is going to tell us? I mean, look, we're talking like names or actual tax data, or I understand the concept, but do you know what sort of data?
Yeah, Senator Boquist, that did come up in the House committee as well. I don't want to preclude what Deanna was going to be talking about, because right now DOR is a partial member, so they're only receiving this information. But that was part of the concern, was is this going to be any information that would run into disclosure issues? And of course, that we would still be limited by disclosure law in some of these cases.
Mr. Chair, okay. Members of the committee, Deanna Mack for the Department of Revenue. And actually, the purpose of this bill, the Oregon Revised Statute 314.835 protects what's called particulars of a return from being shared. Mm-hmm. That includes your name, your Social Security number, items of income, deduction, that kind of thing. And this bill actually would open that statute to allow us to share that information with the software vendors and the IRS, this ISAC group that Kyle talked about. Right now, it's a fraud protection information. When we have what we consider to be high confidence in the information that's reported on a return, we can process it with our system as it goes through. If we have information that makes it look like we have low confidence that this person really is who this person is supposed to be and not a fraudster that's filing something, you know, from another country perhaps, then we can share this information with this IRS Security Summit entity. This bill would allow us, because of the opening of our disclosure statutes, to be a full participant so that we could actually report back to these folks and say these leads were actually, that you shared with us, actually were good or they were not good. And this helps to keep taxpayer refunds in out of the hands of fraudsters and into the hands of the people who are entitled to receive them. So we think this is a good measure to allow us to be a full participant in this group with the IRS rather than just a limited partner. The information is exceptionally secure. There's only two people in the department that can access it. Passwords change on a regular basis. And in fact, for the two people at the department to even get into this system, they have to show, they have to be on some online, like a Skype kind of video thing, and they have to show photo ID at the same time, as well as have all these encrypted passwords that happen all the time. I want to say every 90 or 180 days, they happen pretty regularly. So this bill would actually open our disclosure statute to allow us, in a very narrow sense, to share this information with this entity as part of the IRS Security Summit. It makes the whole nation smarter at being able to share, at being able to combat fraud. And so that's why being a full participant helps not just Oregon, but helps everybody, because it makes everyone smarter about what these fraudsters are trying to do.
Thank you. I need to go like 90,000 feet here. Currently, state police is investigating an ID theft. Can they go to the department and say, give us the tax records for this person? What happened?
Mr. Chair, I have to look at the statute that allows disclosure for that, but I believe that there is authority in statute now for us to share with local law enforcement, state law enforcement, in tax cases. If there's an identity theft ring that is involving, especially because they often do involve taxes, we work with them already. I think that's current law.
Is there something in law that prohibits you from sharing that information with this, the multi-state?
ISAC?
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the statute actually, 314.835 basically says everything's protected, and if you share it, it's a Class C felony, you know, in all these consequences.
Unless it's local police.
314.840 says you can share it, and there's a number of reasons that information can be shared. This particular entity is not in that list.
Okay.
Law enforcement is in that list. U.S. Postal Service for postal fraud is in that list. There are several types of entities that are in that list, but not this one, which was recently created as part of the IRS Security Summit.
Senator Boquist?
I'm looking at the testimony here.
Senator Riley?
So all we're doing with this bill is adding that entity to this list?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Okay, so we have two people in Oregon. How about the 1,000 H&R Block preparers that have access to it? How do we secure they don't do this? I'm simply looking at the testimony.
Senator Boquist.
Right. The H&R Block is a national company, and they, are supporting this, but they are participants in this ISAC at the federal level. And the information goes to one place. The individual preparers don't have the information. This is information that's held at the IRS level, and we run edits and run checks against that data to determine whether we have high confidence in that number and the information reported or not. Then it's sent to the states. But the software vendors send the information up, we send and match, and then we talk to each other. But the individual preparer that's at your local corner shop doesn't have access to this information.
Follow up. Define information.
Senator Chair Haas and Senator Boquist, the information is a particular of a return, and that's what's defined in ORS 314-835, and that is information that could be your Social Security number, your name, your address, your income, your withholding, those kinds of things that are reported on a return. Those are all protected under 314-835 as a particular of a return. So that's the information that we would be sharing with this highly secure entity at the IRS.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm just a no vote. The three of us can't look at tax returns or even redacted tax returns to make policy decisions, but we're going to give it to, I don't know, a gazillion federal IRS agents in a system that gets hacked on a routine basis. So I'm
not sure.
And I'm open here. I'm reading the material from the feds.
I think that's true, but I also have talked to people who've had their identity stolen, and it takes years to unwind some of those problems. Decades.
Right, but I also know people like myself that had it stolen from the government because they hacked the government system. So
I think, but you're in a special case. You're in a special category in several different ways.
I'm in a special category in many ways, Mr. Yeah. Chair, as you're familiar with.
So, but as we know, Mr. Chair, there's absolutely no way that we ever secure all data all the time.
Right.
Not possible. Because the hackers, we have to respond to the hackers. They don't respond to us. And they're always going to be one step ahead of us. And hopefully we'll catch them when they're probing as opposed to when they're armed and getting something out. Because we typically, the way we catch these guys is they don't go in to get information immediately. First, they try to figure out how to get in, and if we catch them at that stage, then we're all set. We can keep them out. The problem is, of the 10,000 hits that DOR gets every day, one of them occasionally gets a little deeper in. Hopefully, not all the way. But where there's absolutely no way to guarantee safety of information wherever it resides.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Rebecca Gladstone.
Testimony. We support this bill. We see it as a straightforward effort from both our revenue and public records positions. The bill would help in collecting taxes while safeguarding personal information as each case is strictly defined. Out of respect to Senator Riley, I would say each case is not strictly defended. It's strictly defined. And then I go into a paragraph for our positions. Efficient economical government, competent personnel, clear assignment of responsibilities, adequate financing. Adequate financing is always a pertinent point. Coordination between agencies and levels of government. Our tax systems should accomplish their objectives without creating undue administrative problems. This bill intends to protect from vulnerability to tax fraud and identity theft. We recommend your support for passage of this bill. And thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to clarify, I'm in favor of this bill. That doesn't mean that that it can't ever be hacked, because it can. But we could be hacked whether we're in this or not. There's no question that it's certainly possible that wherever data resides, it can be found. But we have pretty good systems to catch those intruders before they get the actual information. It's just I'm saying that occasionally, somewhere, sometime, they get in. But I'm in favor of this bill.
Senator Boquist?
Could you expand? I'm trying to understand the notion that this helps us collect more taxes.
I'm sorry, would you please repeat the question a little bit louder?
Yeah, I'll answer. You indicated that there was two purposes here that the league supported it. Obviously the topic we've all been talking about, which is security and identity theft. But you said it would improve the collections. I don't see anything in the testimony or anything in your reports. How do you think this will improve the collection of taxes? I mean, it's a identity fraud issue here. So I'm just looking for some counsel here.
Matt?
You didn't write, right? I was just trying to figure it out. Thanks.
Pardon. Chair Haas, members of the committee, Senator Boquist, may I get back to you on
sure.
that? Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Appreciate it.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2102. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2458, property tax bill. Jamie is making her way up here. Rep. Findley is here. You can come on up, sir, if you would like. We're going to try to fire up our best technology and maybe get a video in the meantime.
We don't have anyone in person, though.
You don't have anyone in person on the video? Just let's go one thing at a time.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2458 deals with a sort of unique piece of property. There is a property that is a biomass boiler system that's been constructed in Narnia County. And essentially it was a collaboration effort for made by a co-op that was created to heat the school and the courthouse. And if that piece of property were used to generate electricity instead of heat and steam, then it would have been considered exempt. And so this bill has been brought forward to treat that heat generating resource in a similar way, and Representative Findley is here to talk about it.
All right, and I think what you were saying is that our person at the other end of the line isn't available.
No, I think we have that. I was just saying that in person, the sign-up sheet is empty.
Oh, okay. Rep. Findley, you
Thank
can see
you,
we
Chair.
We draw a lot of people to this room here, and you might want to hang out here more often.
You know, thank you for the opportunity to leave the House floor. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, Senator Riley, thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today. I'm here to speak with about House Bill 2458. 2458 was originally created at the request of the High Desert Biomass Cooperative located in Burns, Oregon. The property uses a boiler which burns biomass fuel to heat local school and courthouse water to heat the buildings. And I have a lady on that's going to speak in more details of it. At the time the bill was drafted, the High Desert Biomass Cooperative was going through litigation with Department of Revenue to try, because as a centrally assessed property, they were trying to ensure property tax relief. That has been granted as of late, but it's still necessary to go through this process, we believe. House Bill 2458 would exempt from local ad valorem property taxation any property owned or used by cooperatives and the subject of central assessment for the purpose of providing steam or hot water by heat of combustion of biomass. The bill is not unique and would simply expand the current law exempting biomass cooperatives to include biomass cooperatives that use steam or hot water. There are biomass cooperatives right now that generate electricity, and they're exempt. The law clearly says electricity. This cooperative generates steam. So that's why they were not. This bill would fix that. The High Desert Biomass Cooperative has been an excellent example to other rural frontier communities how to develop innovative heating systems that do not contribute to air pollution, reduce fire danger, and allow for the development of biomass markets and create jobs. By expanding this program, we would be encouraging our communities to develop similar economic, viable, and friendly initiatives. As a side note, and I believe the lady will speak later, is a year ago in Harney County, they had a significant windstorm. That windstorm created enough fuel for their biomass cooperative to burn for the next year by just picking up all the trees that fell over in town. It's a great product. It's a great facility. And it's probably where we should be in a lot of regards. I mean, it's a cooperative effort, though. It started when the courthouse boiler went out and the school boiler went out. They were located within six blocks of each other. And they bought one, they went to Finland and bought this boiler to create this steam and generated the system. So it was a great, it was a win-win for everyone. So with that, I think Ms. Lori Cheek hopefully is good to go, and she can answer questions that I cannot.
All right, we'll test our technology here. All right. Wow, there they are. Hi, ladies. Welcome to State Capitol via video. And why don't you identify yourselves? And we're anxious to hear what you have to say on House Bill 2458.
Thank you so much for allowing us to present to you from our home when we didn't have to drive down there. Sorry we couldn't be there. We just want you to know that this is very successful. We've actually added the jail and the sheriff's office, and we've added a church and a mental health drug addiction center, all within six blocks, and we have about 40% more energy that we would like to extend to. We do have very happy people in the courthouse because it's very good heat. It's consistent and there's no dirt or anything else. We strongly, strongly ask that you help us with this. The benefit of having this law is going to allow other communities that do not have natural gas to be able to, if they have biomass. We just took a tour for some people from Umatilla to look at our system. They too can do this. And the advantage of not being taxed saves them a lot of money. That money can go right into expansion, and that's what we're going to do with our savings. My name is Laura Cheek, by the way, and this is Lisa King. We are both on the board of High Desert Biomass as well as on the board of the school district, and I work for Harney County.
Okay. I think from prior testimony in the House that the county is so supportive of this. There was a county judge who testified in favor. So,
Mr. Chair, the county courthouse is in support of it as well as the school district.
You know, maybe Jamie, you know this. If this were to pass, would other similar facilities be granted with this? I mean, if we pass this, will 12 similar facilities join in here?
Chair, House, members of the committee, it's my understanding there aren't currently any other identical properties that would fit into the language of this bill, but they could be created.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that hasn't been mentioned is that we do, as you said, give this credit for these same biomass generators that generate electricity. This one doesn't generate electricity, but it saves electricity.
That's a good point, sir. Absolutely.
That is true, as well as reduces air pollution. It reduces fire danger. So it's both ways. We burn our own smoke. There's no particulate smoke that's released.
Questions of our Harney County team or Rep. Finley?
I do have a question.
Yes, Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Since it's a city and cities aren't taxed, or at least part of it, I'm just curious of the backstory of why you're here. You did mention that the Department of Revenue and Central Assessment. So obviously the Department of Revenue thought that this was taxable. Am I missing something here, or is that correct? How did this—
Chair Hass, Senator Boquist, that's exactly right. The original ruling was that this was not available for tax abatement, and it was taxed. They actually paid property taxes for a year while they went through an application to become tax exempt. And at the same time, in a parallel effort, we introduced this legislation to create the ability to put them there. They've gained their tax exempt status, but it's they're not going back after priors. The tax exempt status is from that date forward. So this would hopefully fix it for others in the future should they come along and clear up any ambiguities. I mean, as long as they maintain a certain percentage of public use, which they are, it will maintain its property tax exempt status.
Okay. Public revenue, did you want to weigh in here? I saw you.
So, Chair Hass, members of the committee, I think that was a good explanation of it. The organization originally was owned by a different entity that was not a governmental entity, and so they were taxable at that time. They were purchased by the governmental entity. They applied for an exemption under other provisions of statute, not under the exemption for government property. During the course of discovery on the case, we realized that in fact, there were no owners in the cooperative that were not governmental entities. We had originally thought that a for-profit drug treatment facility that they're supplying heat for was one of the co-op members, but they're not. And so at this time, they do qualify under 307-030 as a governmental entity. 307-090 as a governmental entity. As a part of their income tax situation, they'll need to maintain a large percentage of the heat being sold to members of the co-op. And as you heard, they're looking to expand. So in the future, if more than 15% of the sales go to non-co-op members, they may have to bring in some of these for-profit entities as co-op members in order to maintain that status under 501c12. And so we think it's prudent to still do the bill, and it will allow them to bring in, say, the for-profit drug treatment facility or some of the other folks in the neighborhood. They've extended the lines through different areas of Burns, and so they're looking to expand who they provide this heat to, as you heard. And so we think it's still prudent. But at this point, the appeal is resolved for the 18-19 tax year going forward. We asked for a motion to dismiss, and I actually just received from the tax court today that dismissal has been approved. So.
Thank you, Mark. That's a good
Thank
explanation.
You. Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
I
you.
I think we're good. Ladies in Harney County, thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Very good.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate it. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to let them do this.
Sure.
Video conference-wise.
Tested our technology strengths here, and I'm proud to say that we passed with flying colors. Good job.
Yeah. This has been like the fifth or sixth time I've done this in a different area, and it's worked extremely well. So it's a great thing. Save those folks. They're only 5 hours away, so it saved them a 10-hour drive.
Yeah.
So I did this from Mexico in leadership meeting.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Rep. Finley. Thank you. Jamie, thank you. I'm going to close out the public hearing on House Bill 2458. That clears our agenda. I don't think we have anything else until tomorrow at 3 o'clock.
At least it was warm.
So we are adjourned.